If you're ready.
You're up.
Okay, so it's Thursday, March 15th, 2007. The Zone 3 Advisory Committee meeting is called to order. And Mr. Benedix, can you call the roll, please?
Yes. I'll call the roll. Is this on? No, Krista.
Okay. Yes, I'll call the roll. I know we have a couple of alternates here tonight, and I'll try to make sure I get this right. Ms. Dean?
Here. I'm sitting in for Jim Hill.
Mr. Ehring?
Here.
For Mr. Versa, Mr. Nichols is here.
You are correct.
Mr. Costello?
Here.
Chairman Gehring?
Here.
Mr. Wallace? Mr. Reynolds?
Here.
We do have a quorum, Mr. Gehring.
Okay, well, thanks, Mr. Benedix. Did you want to talk about the appointment of new members?
Yes. I just wanted to let the committee know that the new alternates and the new members that were recommended to be appointed by the cities and OCSD have been approved by the Board of Supervisors. So they're all official members now.
Okay, thank you. Anybody have any questions on that? Does any member of the public have a comment on anything that is not on the agenda? Yes, ma'am. Please step up and state your name.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Wald, Central Coast Salmon Enhancement. And I've come occasionally to the meetings, and I'm here this evening to give you a brief update on what we're doing as an organization, and also first to express my concern, I'm sure you are as well, with the recent fish kill in Arroyo Grande Creek. And I'm hoping that a quick resolution can be had concerning the fish kill. And I understand the reasons for its occurrence. I have some concerns about how things might unfold down the road regarding this event. And I'm happy to work with the county and see if we can find quick resolution to what happened. An interesting or perhaps different note related to the organization. We are going through some changes. Central Coast Salmon Enhancement has been directed by Connie O'Henley for the last 10 years. Connie has moved on to become the executive director of the Clark Center here in Arroyo Grande. And we have a new director. Her name is Sarah Paddock. And Sarah has been with the organization for almost 3 years. And we're very excited to have a new director. And our board is enthused about our direction. We have been working with the county on the Arroyo Grande Stream Gauge project that will begin a design phase very soon. And, of course, we're continuing to work on a variety of issues in the creek, working with the city of Arroyo Grande on ivy removal here in Kiwanis Park, right across from where we are, along with addressing some of the barriers in the system, including Cachetti Road, which, of course, the county will have a part to play in. And so, in short, we're still here, and we will look forward to working with the county down the road in terms of the health and welfare of Arroyo Grande Creek. Thanks.
Thank you. Could you give me your last name again, please? Wald?
Wald, W-A-L-D.
Wald. Okay, thank you. Does anybody have any questions for Ms. Wald? No? Well, then, we'll go on to the minutes of January 18, 2007. Anybody have a chance to go through them? Any questions, any changes?
If I could, Mr. Gehring, somehow I put Mr. Costello as the wrong city representative, and I apologize. I'll fix that. I don't know how that happened.
Thank you. Comments or other Tom?
No, I have nothing, Mr. Chairman. I'll move they stand and prove is mailed out with a correction.
I'll second the motion.
All right, we have a motion and a second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Mr. Mellon, I think you're up for the Lopez Recreation Status Report.
Good evening. Don Mellon, Supervising Ranger, Lopez Lake. You all got the copy of the rec report. Our visitation has been consistent during this period. We've had a couple warm weekends and over the last few weeks, which has produced a full hookup camping areas. We've had no critical incidents. We've got fish plants coming from the Department, California Department of Fish and Game, and the county paid for plants, the Calaveras Lunker plants, continue, and they're held on a monthly basis. We have our monthly interpretive activities continue. As of October of 2006, we had hit 3,000 people that we had run through our year-round interpretive program. So we've been doing that for almost 2 years now, where rather than just run interpretive events during the summer, we run them year-round. So it provides more of a benefit to the local communities. And we have a lot of people coming out to things like we have an owl call evening where they come out, we call the owls, and they come down and they're able to see great horned owls and barn owls up close. And it's been very successful with a lot of the local community. Infrastructure repairs are underway. We've redesigned Mustang Campground, eliminated a few of the sites just to make it much more aesthetically pleasing. We've put some natural barriers and some fencing in. We've also been working on converting a day-use group area to a camping group area, an area that was not very frequently used by day users, and it seems to be more popular. Group camping is more popular than ever right now. We're still waiting on the California Department of Boating and Waterways to give full approval. We've got a tentative approval, but they're still reviewing the plans in segments, and what happens is they ask for a segment of the plans for this grant that they've approved, and we'll send it in, then they'll approve that, and then we have to send in the second segment. So I was really hoping this would have been completed by last summer, and it looks like now they'll probably start construction before this summer, which is kind of typical for maintenance projects, is if we're going to get them, they're going to be right in our busy season. Other than that, you can see our attendance has been about stable. Our revenue's been up, partially due to some fee increases, and the lake levels listed on there. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, thanks, Don. Any questions for Mr. Mellon? Tom?
Don, if the money is held up and you don't get it until the busy season, is there any way to put that money in account and hold on to it until things slow down in the fall?
I'm going to do everything I can to make that happen, because I hate to see a project start in May, because I'm afraid that we won't get everything that we have coming to us in a way. And it just creates such a tangle, particularly when you know what the launch ramp can be like during that part of the year. If I can get them to hold off until, say, September, because right now we're going to get to the point of no return here. You know, we're already in March, middle of March. I don't see this being fully approved until. It's really hard to say. I keep working closely with our planner, but he's only able to provide me with information that he gets from the state. So, but I'll do everything I can, because I don't want to inconvenience our constituents. That's the last thing I want to do. And plus, it just creates so many other problems when we've got half the parking lot closed off. So,
thank you.
Mr. Nichols, anything?
No.
Mr. Ted?
I have nothing. Thank you.
No. Okay. Well, thank you, Don. Nice to see you again. And Mr. Benedict, that looks like you're up for the operations report.
Yes, thank you. I distributed to you, was not included in the agenda package, operations report for January and February. It has a lot of the details of data that we compile, water quantity and rainfall by individual agency. So that's here for your information. That's been approved. Accumulate over a long period of time, the format, et cetera, on that. I just want to bring that to your attention. The report on the Lopez project, the water treatment plant, which currently is half of the plant, is able to produce water because we are upgrading the system to provide a new water treatment plant, as most of you know. So I'm talking about half the plant, basically. That half a plant is producing about 3.5 million gallons of water a day. That plant was designed for 6 million gallons a day total. three on each side. We are able to, because we have all four filters for the entire plant available to us, we can process more than just the 3 million gallons of water per day. So the plant is presently producing 3.5 million gallons. We're obtaining and distributing about 2 million gallons of state water a day. No particular operational problems right now with the plant. The lake level is at about 82%, and you probably know that that's been 82% for quite a while. We're very fortunate with the little bit of rain that we have had, but we're holding very stable there at that point. We, as you most of you probably know, we unfortunately had a release of coagulant down the out of the plant system on March 2nd and 3rd, and I've asked Mark Hutchinson, who is the Public Works Department spokesman for this event, to come and share with you a short summary of that information.
Thanks, Dean. Chairman Gehring, members of the committee, Mark Hutchinson, Department of Public Works. As Dean pointed out, and as you've probably read in the newspaper, there was a spill of coagulant from the plant. The afternoon of March 2nd, the operators, following their normal procedure, filled the mixing tank from the storage tank, closed the valve, and on their morning checks on Saturday, discovered the mixing tank overflowing onto the floor, which is our primary containment, leaving the building through the floor drains, entering the sludge pond, which functions as secondary containment, and then an amount of the fluid actually overflowed the sludge pond and ultimately into Rio Grande Creek. We determined that the failure was due to a broken piece internal to the valve. There was no error on the part of the operators. They had no way of knowing that the valve actually didn't fully close because externally it indicated that it had. When they discovered the leak, they used other backup valving to shut that off, notified our water lab, who responded to the scene. We notified the Regional Water Quality Control Board per the requirements of our discharge permit and began monitoring and sampling in the creek. It wasn't until Monday morning, in concert with Fish and Game, that they actually discovered dead fish. There were six or seven, I'll call them salmonids, either rainbow trout, which would be planted fish, or potentially the native steelhead, were found dead. Those were collected along with a number of what's commonly called suckers in excess of 25. All of those animals and samples have been collected by the Department of Fish and Game. They forward that to their laboratory in Sacramento for a full investigation. The plant operators have added additional containment and with modified procedures to ensure that we don't have an additional spill between now and the next very short time period when the new plant goes online, in which case the design of that plant would prevent any such accident from actually getting into the creek. So we're disappointed that this close to the new plant that we had a mechanical failure. As the environmental programs manager, I'm very pleased with the response of the staff at the plant and also their concern for the environmental damage. At this point in time, internal to the county, we're considering a number of responses that we can make, and we'll be consulting with the agencies, Department of Fish and Game, Regional Board, National Marine Fisheries, and Fish and Wildlife, all of who have been notified, about actions that we can take at this point towards assessing what the damage might be. We don't have any indication from the agencies of what their response will be, what sort of fines and sanctions may or may not come out of this, as they're basically put a lid on information until they finish their investigation. With that, I'll try to answer any questions that you might have. Hopefully nothing that begins with "on advice of counsel."
So any questions for Mark?
Tom, I have one. Mr. Chairman, is this the first time in the 30-plus years of that plant operating that we've had something like this happen?
Actually, I don't have any history, but I haven't heard any mention of any similar type incident since the plant's been operating. I imagine we'll find that out from the regional board as they go through their records. But
thank you.
Mr. Chairman? I do have a question really concerning entire operations. We don't, on the weekends, we don't have anybody around that plant at all. I mean, we don't have kind of a person that goes around and, oops, this is off?
No, you're on.
I'm on. You just want me talking to it. Okay, that's what the guy's flagging me down there. He can't hear, huh? Okay. One of the things that concerns me is that we don't have somebody on the weekends that does any checking. And I just kind of asked the question, do we have anybody that goes around there and checks on the weekends?
Yes, we do. The plant is staffed 7 days a week. However, on Saturday and Sunday, it's staffed basically from 7:30 to 4. And even during that time, we have what's called a shift operator, who is a certified plant operator. And he shows up there on Saturday morning and on Sunday morning, and he does rounds at the plant. He also goes to the recreation area at Lopez. He also goes down to the Country Club wastewater treatment plant and does checking and does rounds down there. So each Saturday and Sunday we have someone, but we don't have anyone from basically 4 o'clock every afternoon to 7:30 the next morning right now. I will say that with a proviso that when we start up the new membrane plant, which will be sometime May, June, July, for a period of time, we will likely have more than 8-hour shifts, potentially 12 or 16 or even 24 hours a day for a short period of time. But and we don't know at this point what kind of staffing we'll need for maybe a mature plant, if you will, after we operate that for a while. We understand how the membrane system works and its anomalies and unusual characteristics and requirements, how we're going to man that. We're not sure at this point. We don't anticipate it's 24 hours a day because that would grow our staff in addition to what we have right now.
It would seem to me that that's the last place where you have open water before it goes into pipes and things of that nature. So it would seem to me that there might be even a security problem here.
The plant is secure in that it has a fence around it that you can't drive into the plant. The new plant, I don't know if Mark didn't mention this, but I guess I can say this because it's been in the paper, right? The new plant will have containment features so that if some of these tanks were to leak, that they would stay in a dead concrete storage basin under the tank and there would be no release to anything else. It'd be right there.
It's also important to note that critical elements of the plant do have, my understanding is, have alarms on them. So if any of the water treatment processes were to fail when no one was there, it does trigger an alarm, and there is staff who's on a quick response mode. And it happens that we do have staff who actually live at the plant, and they, although they weren't on duty, were able to respond fairly rapidly and assist in containing the spill that we did have. Unfortunately, the alarm is keyed to, in this part of the plant, making sure that the appropriate amount of the chemical is being mixed into the feed system. It doesn't have an overflow alarm that tells you that it's running onto the floor. And, of course, in the new plant, that's handled by ensuring that there's enough containment to hold any chemical that should leak if there's not someone physically present in that part of the plant at that time.
I'm kind of used to facilities, for example, when you don't have enough people to staff, 100% of the time. TV cameras that rotate on the top, and they can be seen in automobiles, and so you can have one guy taking care of many facilities, and he's still able to see what's going on, or at some position you might have some staff office where that TV is, you can monitor it. I realize that we try to minimize costs and all that kind of stuff, but I don't know. I come from the oil business, so I'm used to seeing these kinds of things on platforms and on facilities on shore, which are basically waterworks, a good many of them.
Well, we have one camera that is in the operator's office at this time, but that's just a security camera for the entrance of the plant. That's the only one we do have. And the new plant is not going to have any kind of full camera security system. That that was not included. I don't know. Mr. Gehring probably has more history than anyone in here. At the time the design was being done, we did make quite a few cuts of that project to try to keep the cost down. And I don't know if that was even considered at the time. But
Myself, I don't recall that.
That's all I have, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Joe, did you have anything?
Is it an industry standard that this type of facility is not manned 24 hours a day?
It's up to the facility operation. It's very unique to each facility. There's one in Bakersfield. There's one in Fresno. There's several up in the Northern California area, and they all operate depending on the size, the complexity. They operate 16-hour shifts, 12-hour shifts, 24-hour shifts. It's really up to the operational facility how they want to do that.
What I'm hearing you say, though, is that the new facility coming online sometime in the next 3 to 4 months is got some safety features built into it that will be safeguards if we have some type of a spill like this.
Yes, the containment areas that I mentioned, that if we had a leak of a chemical tank or tote or bin, would go into a basin, and there's an alarm in that basin that tells you that is fills up. As a matter of fact, we're dealing with some issues where when it rains, rainwater will go into that basin, and rain will make an alarm saying that there's a chemical spill in that basin when it's just really rain. So
It sounds like that we've got some nice features built in, but it also sounds like we might want to do some contingency studies, and if there are any issues that we see could create problems, that perhaps some sort of a camera system might not be a bad backup for this.
Yes, I'm sure as a result of this, we will be taking a hard look going back in the new system here to make sure that we don't have a one valve that if it failed, we were to have some type of problem, because, you know, it creates issues that don't need to be there. We have a lot more containment security with the new system plus alarms, but I'm in the process of starting through the design and the site construction to make sure that we don't have this potential again with basically a double security system on our outflow that goes down to the basins, to the creek.
Thank you.
Ms. Dean?
I'm just hoping we only had one valve there that is holding the coagulants. Do you have more than one valve that controls that?
Actually, there are three.
There are three. And you've checked them.
Yes.
Yes.
And one of them is brand new.
Good.
Mark, do we know or do we not know how many steelhead were involved?
Well, we know that there are seven that potentially were steelhead, and I'm sure the Fish and Game is doing the studies to confirm exactly what species, depending on how long they had actually been dead, make it more difficult to determine whether we're dealing with steelhead or the planted rainbow trout. But the number is six or seven at this point.
In terms of sanctions, do we currently believe that there's no likelihood of criminal prosecution?
Well, whether it's a civil or criminal is... Well, I would be surprised if they came out with a criminal sanction, but there are minimum penalties per the Water Code, which I haven't confirmed. I know what the maximum penalties are, given that this was a single event, and the amount of gallonage is in the 1,500 range, that under the Fish and Game Code and the State Water Code, for straight penalties, we're looking at something around $15,000 each maximum. The Endangered Species Act is another matter. Violations of that are $25,000, and that can easily be per fish, depending on how they calculate it. Our larger concern is what sort of total and potentially ongoing natural resource damage there might be. That's where... efforts to mitigate for that can run into larger amounts.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else have any other questions?
Yeah, I'd like to follow up that question. What kind of residual effects do we see from this kind of a spill? It was 1,500 gallons. It was stopped. What happened next? Did we remediate it? Do we clean it? Does the creek flush itself out and make things equilibrium back to equilibrium, or what happens?
Well, the chemical itself is slightly denser than water, so the presumption is that without extensive mixing, it would lay along the bottom of the creek, which may or may not have something to do with the species of fish and the numbers. That may have more to do with what kind of fish were actually in the creek. It will bind up particulates in the water. That's what it's intended to do. It is water soluble, but in the plant requires mixing. The manufacturer, it's a proprietary mix, but primarily aluminum chloride, assures us that it is the least toxic coagulant on the market, but that's the company selling it. I can tell you that polyaluminum chloride, the straight polyaluminum chloride, is classed as a hazardous substance by EPA. This particular mix, this variation, is classified as a non-hazardous substance. But in the water, reacting with aquatic organisms, it would tend to, as a slime, for a better word, coat the gills and then coagulate with sediment and then prevent the fish from getting oxygen out of the water because it's plugged up. It does break down in the water. It's water soluble. It's also attacked and consumed by bacteria in the water. At this point, if you go look at the creek, you can't see any evidence that there's anything in the water. I haven't seen the results of some testing of sediments. We just got that back, and I haven't seen it yet. The agencies, of course, consider if there's an immediate response required, shut the water off, speed the water up, try to vacuum it out. None of that seemed viable at the time, and so far the agencies haven't indicated that there was, other than shutting it off and notifying them, that there's really anything that would be not creating more damage. We, if we do a natural resource assessment, of course, then we would compare the affected stretch of the creek to stretches upstream and try to gauge the amount of aquatic life that's going on either side. There are live fish in the stream now, at least at Schroeder Park and down, but we have, because it's private property, haven't been able to do a full assessment of the creek channel immediately downstream of the plant. From what we could see, there's no physical evidence of the chemical in the water.
Thank you.
One more question, Mr. Chairman. Mark, how far downstream did that travel?
We don't know. Our staff followed it downstream from Sachetti Road. There was some agricultural irrigation going on that was discharging in the creek. So at about that point, the water became cloudy, and it was impossible to tell. We were following, or our staff was following, a milky blue tint in the water, and from Cachetti down, I believe, in that area, it was impossible to see if it was still in the water and what concentration. And that would be, if we do a natural damage assessment, that would be one of the issues, is to try to gauge through some methodology of how far down we can actually trace impacts. Stream is flowing at about, I want to say, 10 cubic feet per second at Cachetti. Picks up 3 or 4 cubic feet per second by the time it gets downtown. That's pretty low for the wintertime, but there are other influences coming in.
Well, that's going to be a big deal, but really, to me, it doesn't make any difference. It's done. It's over with. You're not going to be able to change anything but throw a bunch of money at it.
Mr. Earing.
Can you get into the creek? Do they let you get into the creek to do any kind of cleanup or anything like that? You can. I mean, you'll have a cause more damage than if you go in? Or?
They've been trying to clean the creek down the lower end of the valley, and they won't let you get in and do it. So why should they do it up here?
Well, that's one of the considerations, is whether or not attempting to remove it, if it still could be captured, whether that would do more damage than allowing it to break down naturally.
Yeah, that's my point. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, it's a serious event, and I guess a thought I have, and I welcome anything that the other committee members might suggest, but one thing we could do would be to have the technical committee agendize this for a special meeting and to brainstorm and see what other preventative measures might be reasonable that we don't think of here at this committee, and perhaps report back at a future time. That'd be one thing that could be done. Anybody else have any suggestions?
Only asking the company that sells a product if there's some kind of thing that can
that binds it up. I mean, if there ought to be some kind of another chemical that, I don't know if it'd be worse to put it in there, or, but something that would bind it.
Well, we have been in
contact. If it's soluble, eventually it'll dissolve. But
we have been in contact with the manufacturer, the distributor in Bakersfield,
yeah,
and have gotten all the information they have on the chemical.
Maybe their chemist that manufactured this product will have something to say and do. Rather than just talking to their people, maybe they need to consider the seriousness of that chemical in creeks and what we could do about it. You know, if there's nothing we can do, there's nothing we can do. But we should. I think we should have the technical committee at least chase this rabbit and find out whether or not there is some kind of thing that can be done.
I got a question for Dean, Mr. Chairman. How much larger would the holding pond have to be to contain a 24-hour spill like this if it should ever happen again?
Well, the volume is minimal. The problem is that as it got into the water in through the downstream sludge basin, the water carried it out into the creek area. So
that's after the holding basin was full?
There was no holding basin for this release. It basically drained, as Mark said, onto the floor through a site drain that takes rainwater, et cetera, and went into the sludge pond, which is pretty large. Sludge pond's what, about a half acre, Mark? I mean, each one's pretty big. But the problem is there was other water coming into that sludge pond from the backwash of the facilities when it's on automatic, and that water is intended to filter, settle, and then the excess drain into the creek, which is what we have the permit for. So unfortunately, the coagulant joined that water and went out into the creek with it.
Well, if no one on the committee objects, I'll request that we agendize this for the technical committee to do a review on.
I'll second that.
I think it's a really good idea.
All right. Thank you, Mark.
Mr. Gehring, may I ask, do you want to have a special meeting or address that on April 5th at the next regularly scheduled TAC meeting?
Well, I think April 5th that's not very far away.
So. Okay.
Unless somebody thinks we should do it sooner. And Mr. Benedict, we're through with plant upgrade status, or are we?
We're through with the operations report.
Operation report, okay. Then you're on for upgrade status.
Yes, thank you. I'm going to have Mr. Beaton, our water quality lab manager, help me with the exhibit. In your package, you will see under item, should be item 4 in your packet, executive summary report prepared by our construction manager, Montgomery Watson Harza. Has been providing this and preparing this throughout the project. We're about 15 months into the project at this point, and this is the upgrade of the water treatment plant from a filtration system to a membrane system. And I'll first address the pictures on the right. Maybe you can just enlarge those, John. On the left side, you see the membrane modules, which have been installed. Those have basically been completely tested now by the Paul Corporation. Those are ready to go pretty much. We need a little bit of more training on those, and effectively within 2 or 3 days those membranes could be producing water. That's only part of the system. That's the backbone of the existing one of the existing filtration basins, the concrete basins. There's a lot of concrete work that has been done. That work's been going on about almost 4 months now, and we're nearly complete with the concrete work. The next month or so, the contractor will be installing, we call that DAF, dissolved air flotation. He'll be installing the actual equipment that operates and does that pretreatment function. The contractor will next go to upcoming activities. We'll be going to installing several final components of the chemical treatment systems that we have for the new process. And again, I'll just reiterate this. This is a plant that we are producing water at. We're continuing to do that, and we're integrating this system all at the same time. And it takes a lot of coordination. I met the last 2 days. I've been meeting with the designer, Black & Veatch, with the contractor, Cushman, with our construction manager and my staff and operations staff. And I'm actually exhausted because of I've been focusing on how all this is going to come together and the contractor's responsibility, Black & Veatch's responsibility to do all the software, the integration of this system to make sure all the systems talk to each other and they're activated properly. Black & Veatch is doing that programming, installing that software for us, and setting up all the screens that operate this system. Paul Corporation is a separate contract under the county to furnish and install the entire membrane equipment. I should say furnish the equipment. The contractor, Cushman, has installed all that equipment. This is very interesting in having subcontractors for the prime contractor that aren't his subcontractor, that the district's contractor. So we have a little bit of a dilution of responsibility, and we're trying to keep all those things in line and at the same time continue to produce water and provide enough water. I will just mention also that we are taking a little bit more state water than we normally would at this time in order to make up for what we are losing by not having the second existing, the old treatment train working. We're only down to one of the two trains working now. And that's going along very well. The state is cooperating with us and providing us a little bit extra water, and hopefully will be as we continue here to get toward when we start the plant up. On the left side of the screen, or on the summary here, you'll see some schedule. These are some of the critical items that we are in the process of being under construction. And at the bottom, you have put together a contract specifications to require the contractor to do what he needs to do, but let him do what we need to do and bring all this together at one time. And it's really a giant headache. It really is. We're getting a lot of cooperation from everyone, and I'll say Cushman is providing a lot of cooperation because they are assisting our contractors, which are not his subcontractors, in bringing this whole thing together. The conclusion of our meeting today of how we were going to start this plant, have established, and this is the newest information that this is pretty new. I haven't even written it down yet, but May 15th is a date that we want to turn the plant on and start running the dissolved air flotation pretreatment water through this total filtration system. That's a milestone that we're shooting at and that we have established and we're going to hopefully work with so we can start processing water, we can start doing testing, we can start gathering data. The documentation systems are online. Things will start going wrong that we can continue to test and adjust and fix and have everybody there. And hopefully, it's my hope that we can have processed water going into the distribution system from the membrane, hopefully by middle of June. I was hoping a month ago that it was going to be middle of May, but we've had some issues that we've had to work through. And at this point, we have a little bit of leeway, but we're trying to get that system started and running to get some of the bugs out of it as soon as we can. But it's quite a coordination issue when you have contracts that are not clear and concise. And in the meantime, we have tapped into our systems and have to run our system and trying to run this new system at the same time. So everybody is cooperating, and I think we're doing well with it. But it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. That concludes my report on the upgrade project.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Benedict. And questions for Dean? Tom, we'll start on your side.
I have nothing, Mr. Chairman.
No questions, only my compliments to the good work that you're doing.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
No questions.
Ed? I would just like to compliment you on keeping this thing as close to schedule as you possibly can, and it looks like you're doing a good job.
There's a lot of people that are doing a lot of hard work on it.
Ms. Dean, anything?
Yes, thank you.
Wanted to announce, in addition to our finance staff, Jennifer Colvard. Jennifer comes to Public Works with a great deal of county experience as well as experience in public accounting. and she will be the new Flood Control Zone 3 accountant, and we are very happy to have her with us. We will be transitioning the responsibilities over the next few months, so the transition will hopefully be quite seamless, which I'm sure it will be. Oh, okay. Oh, geez. Okay, thanks.
Jennifer, could you tell? Could you spell your last name for me? I didn't get that.
C-O-L-V-S-Victor-A-R-D.
Okay, thank you. It's just like it sounds.
Cool for it.
Security and technology definitely get in the way sometimes. Okay, on to the budget. Tonight's presentation will encompass three categories, and will last about 5 minutes. And I'll go through the budgeting processes involved, give you an overview of the 2007-2008 budget, and answer any questions after the presentation. But if you have any questions as we go along, please don't hesitate to ask. The budget review process has four steps, which are as follows. In January, we met with your advisory committee on January 18th, where the public works staff distributed and briefly discussed the 2007-2008 budget. In February, the public works staff met with the finance committee members of your cities, as well as the technical advisory committee members, and again reviewed the budget and had a question and answer session as well. We are now returning the budget process to your committee for your endorsement. And on from June 18th through the 20th, the Board of Supervisors will be reviewing and approving budgets, one of which will be Flood Control Zone 3. The next slide will be a graph of an overview of the estimated versus actual budget, actual billings for Flood Control Zone 3. This graph compares the estimated Zone 3 billings to actual. We've done this analysis for 2007-2008 using the January 2006 five-year billing estimate, which would the increase between last fiscal year and our proposed budget for 2007-2008 is $596,000. Overall expenditures have increased 13%, but this is primarily due to the increase in our state revolving fund loan payment, which is the financing for the required Lopez Water Treatment Plant upgrade project. Total operations and maintenance has increased less than 1%, which we're really proud about that. Debt service has increased 59%, which, as I mentioned, is due to the increase in the state revolving fund loan payments. And capital outlay has decreased 28%. We had an additional request for a tractor, which came after the budget book had gone to print. And I know that we discussed this at the last advisory committee meeting, and we also discussed it at the finance committee meeting and the technical advisory committee meetings. This tractor would be used exclusively by Flood Control Zone 3. And the purchase of this would be producing actual savings in future years. We're planning to submit this to the Department of Health Services as part of the Lopez Water Treatment Plant Upgrade Project. If for some reason it's not covered by the loan proceeds, then we will pay for it out of reserves. And this concludes my report. I'd be happy to answer any questions at this time.
Okay, thanks, Straith. And Tom, question.
How fancy a tractor is that supposed to be?
90,000.
Well, yeah, but I mean,
defer to Dean on that one.
It's
sorry, Dean.
Going to get two Cadillacs and a driver to go with it.
And a limousine. Yes. No. It's that's the price with all the attachments that they anticipate that they would need.
Backhoe scoop.
That's correct. That's correct. It's I don't know anything about tractors other than. That's the price that we got for what we thought we would need for any kind of operations that we'd have. And I don't straight didn't mention, I believe, that the projection that Ron Coleman, our superintendent, gave was that we would pay that back in about four to 5 years based on
the equipment rentals, the lease, et cetera, that we do, not including the downtime of our staff that has to go chase around finding this stuff to have one right there available. And I will mention what we anticipate doing, as we do with our staff, is when our staff works at a different...
Okay.
Thank you.
The tractor is a track tractor, not rubber tire tractor.
I believe it's rubber tire tractor.
Oh,
but I'm not positive.
I would think so.
I believe it is.
And Mrs. Dean, any questions? How are we going to set the rental rate?
Well, we could use a Caltrans rental rate. We could use a which is basically based on the retail rental rates of rental companies.
Doesn't the county have an in-house rate that they charge back and forth between different departments?
Do we?
Yes, we do. Our accountants has rates that she will charge for use of equipment that I'm sure that would be what we would use if we were to end up loaning the tractor out. So there are pre-established rates, but
we do that for all of our roads equipment, yeah, for various, and I'm sure it would be something with that same range. I don't know what the rate is, though.
Offhand, I'm not sure what it is either, but if it's something you'd like for me to follow up on, I'd be happy to do so.
Could you pass that on to the technical committee, the rental rate?
Yes, I'd be happy to.
So any other questions?
My only other question is, and we've gone through this several times, if you will take this sheet that's part of us on page 4, and this is the first time that we got a breakdown of how much per acre foot that the water costs and per each entity. Do you have that to put up, Seth?
Yes, I do.
Which page are you on, Tom?
It's on page 4 in the budget, and this was a handout that she gave us at the last meeting. It's the cost per acre foot summary 07-08 year, right there. And the question that I brought up is that, from my understanding, we all pay the same amount for the water coming from the lake down to the bus barn. And when you meld all these costs together and you get down to line 9, Arroyo Grande is the closest entity to the spigot, so to speak, and we've got $1,120 an acre foot charge, and that includes all the things that go along with it. And I don't understand why Arroyo should be getting charged $100 an acre foot.
In regards to the cost per acre foot, I'm not sure if you can see this well enough. Do you have your budget booklets with you?
What page
if you would refer to page 12. That might be easier to follow along, because I realize this is kind of blurry from the distance.
There we go. 12. Okay.
Thank you. Okay. The debt service will vary according to each agency, and it's due to primarily two factors. The first part of the equation is the net bond payments for both the COP, which is the Certificate of Participation Bonds, and the general obligation bond costs. These are the annual bond payments, which are in row 6 on your on page 12. Are we all there?
And which line are you on, sir?
Okay.
Total debt service.
Total debt service, which would be row 6. Row 6, column G. Okay, so that is the total debt service, which is, or the annual bond payments, excuse me. And then we deduct the various district revenues on rows 10 through 13, which then gives us the allocatable debt service on line 14. And I'm answering your question eventually. I just want to give a little bit of background to it.
So you're down $300,000 in round figures from,
yes,
line number 6.
Yes. Okay. So what is allocated on line 14 is your allocatable debt service, and that is allocated according to entitlement. which is your for our newer members or some of our alternate members, the entitlement is the entitlement percentage is your the total acre feet that your city is taking divided by the total number of acre feet that is available. And those the entitlement figures are on row 19 for each one of your agencies. So the second factor that we need to consider is the allocation of the property taxes, which is allocated differently from the bond from the bond obligation. This is based on the assessed valuation of each city, the percentages being listed in row 1 underneath. Their total portion of the bond obligation is $847,000, which is on row 21, column B. And the way that is calculated is the $1.6 million on line 14 times the entitlement. So that would give you $847,000. And then the Arroyo Grande's portion of the general obligation tax the general obligation tax collection is allocated differently from the bond obligation because it's based on the assessed valuation, which is for Arroyo Grande, it's 34.66. So that would give Arroyo Grande a net credit of $305,000, roughly, in property tax. The difference between these two lines is the billable debt service, which would be $542,000, plus the SRF loan of $594,000, making a total debt service of $1.1 million. And this is what this results in a cost per acre foot of $946 just on the debt service component calculation. So in summary, it's because the two components in the debt service part of the cost per acre foot, because they're two different percentages, that's...
In other words, if I'm understanding this correctly now, it's the assessed value that throws this whole number askew.
You're correct. That's right.
Okay. Now, I had never been able to... We didn't explain it quite that well before on the phone.
Okay.
All right. So the more assessed value you have, supposedly the lesser amount of cost it would be per acre foot.
Yes, you're right. The more your assessed value is, the less your cost per acre foot.
Okay.
How often is that assessed value redone?
It's done each year.
Each year?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but I mean, it's done each year, but does it change? I mean, okay, are you talking about assessed valuation of property within the city, or are the assets within the city?
The assessed valuation of the property.
Okay. How often does an appraiser come out and reappraise the value of
what our percentages were last year? And the changes were really immaterial. It was less than 0.001, it does shift, you know, according to property selling, which raises the assessed valuation in our area. So it has always been increasing, but again, the change has not been that significant from prior years. But it is done on an annual basis.
Mr. Nichols, do you have anything?
Absolutely nothing. Mr. Costello?
No, I have no questions on it.
I got my question answered. I'm not sure I'm satisfied with the answer.
Well, what?
That's all right.
would you? What could I follow up on for you?
Well, you've told me. I mean, it's annually done. It's state certified, but I don't see Bordenero out here assessing any property. So I was wondering.
They raise mine 2%.
You know,
2% every year by automatic.
Yeah.
Automatic. You're limited under Proposition 13. I mean, I suppose why it doesn't change very much is because of the fact that under Proposition 13, if the property's been held for a very long time, it could only go up 2%. per year, and so the assessed valuation doesn't change very much. I think the average overall has been something like about 1.5% or something like that.
Well, I think the drivers in the increasing of the rates is because when property is sold, it because of the area that we live in, the assessed value of the property goes up.
Yeah.
And so that's why it will shift.
Yeah, but it doesn't change hands too much. You know, most of the time is what we're doing is adding, new.
When it does change hands, there's a big gap in there.
Yeah, right. Okay.
This is information that's provided to us from the auditor's office as far as the percentages go. And because we haven't had some huge shifts, we really haven't, you know, ask too many questions about it, but I would be happy to follow up on, you know, more details on this process if you'd like.
Hey, that's not necessary.
Okay.
We got off on a tangent here, I think, because of the question was asked. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mrs. Dean, do you have anything you want to ask?
Nothing.
Yeah, what Straith would like is an endorsement, I think, of this budget, the 07-08 budget, including the tractor.
That's correct.
Mr. Costello?
Yes.
Mr. Gehring?
Yes.
Mr. Reynolds?
Yes.
And Mr. Nichols?
Yes.
Thank you.
And thank you for all.
Straith? Although you're still up there, though, aren't you? Oh, go ahead, Tom. Sorry.
Well, I just wanted to thank her for this and the county staff for putting this together, because this is the first time in many years that I've been here that I've seen a breakdown like this that we could get our teeth into and tear apart and ask some legitimate questions.
Well, you're welcome. You're welcome.
I hope because we got a new accountant, you're not going to back away from this.
Yet. Oh, no, not at all.
All right.
Not at all.
Because I think this was well done. It sure helped me for my first time here to see this budget, and I think it was a commendable job.
Well, thank you. It's the department's work. It's everyone in the department.
Could I ask that in the future we do see the cost per acre foot in each budget then when it comes through?
Yes, we had planned on providing that information. So we probably won't do it as part of the booklet, but we'll do it as a separate handout as we did this year.
That's fine.
Is that all right? Okay.
As long as everybody gets a handout.
We'll make sure of that.
All right, thank you. And Straith, you're still up, I think. Are you still up or not?
I don't think so. I think I'm done. The water treatment plant upgrade, well, if you have any questions on that report.
The plant upgrade budget tracking?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's more of an informational item than anything, but if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those as well.
And I just would note that's item 5-1 and 5-2 in your agenda packet.
I just had a question, and maybe it's come up before. I just don't remember the answer, and that is under the on 5-1, county staff time and overhead, the original budget looks like it was 227, and it's gone up quite a bit, and I just wondered if you could talk about that for a second.
A significant part of that was due to the pilot testing that was done before we started installing the upgrade. We had serious problems with trying to determine what the membrane capacity and product capability was. And I don't know the exact numbers, but I think we effectively probably doubled that $227,000 just to get through the membrane testing pilot study, which we took one module and we spent about a year trying to push water through it and different chemicals and test. And it was a very difficult process, and there was a significant amount of expenditures for doing that. And that included additions. From now, I can tell you that same thing. But what we know right now, we look like we have enough contingency to get us through this project.
Anybody have anything else on plant upgrade budget tracking? Okay, thank you, Straith.
You're welcome.
Interim downstream release schedule.
Dean. Yes, we will call that the IDRIS. For short, if that's okay. There's a couple of items we have under the IDRIS update that we want to give you. Since Mark was here to talk about some other issues, I asked him to talk about the IDRIS and the HCP both. I think Mark's going to give you an update on where we are with that plan, and he might also even give a summary, Mark, of what that is.
I think probably most of the members know, but and then I have some comments in response to some questions we had in the past that I'd like to handle.
Okay, thanks, Dean. Mark Hutchinson again, Department of Public Works. I didn't bring my slideshow with me this time. As you're aware, most of you are aware, I have over the past month visited each of the governing bodies of each of your agencies and endeavored to make the same identical presentation regarding the implementation of the interim downstream release schedule, which, as you're all aware, is a plan that we developed in concert with the Technical Advisory Committee to more efficiently manage the downstream release between now and when the HCP is ultimately approved. And the basics of it are, as we are aware, primarily wintertime wet season reductions in releases from the dam that are offset by natural flow increases in the creek. I made that presentation and highlighted the potential risks and the, of doing that, both economic and regulatory, and discussed the measures that we have built into the plan in order to mitigate those risks. Program was fairly well received at all five agencies. There was no strong objection from any of the governing boards, although no one jumped up and announced that it was the greatest thing they'd ever seen. We got essentially a receive and file response across the board. So the next step with the IDRIS is to take it to the County Board of Supervisors and ask for them to adopt the resolution that accompanied the packet that all of you saw. I've drafted that staff report and launched it into the administrative process of getting on our board with a scheduled date of April 17th. Minimally, are still reading an increase in flow as we come downstream from the dam, which bodes well for a normal winter season. The concept of having a saturated watershed that would allow us to reduce flows at the dam seems to be, we're using at least the data from the dry winter to show that that should work well in a good average wet winter. So we're anticipating some savings there. The stream gauges are in. We have a little bit more work to do with some surveying at Rodriguez, but they are in, and you can read them via the internet on the department's website if you can navigate through that. It takes me a while to find it, but they are there. So you can see about a 2 or 3 day record and numbers. I think it reports every half hour, every hour or so. So you can actually see what's happening in the stream. I'll stop at that point if you have any questions on the IDRIS and where we're at with that before I move on to the HCP in general.
Where are the gauges located, Mark?
We have gauge at Rodriguez Bridge, which is the first road crossing below the dam. We have staff gauges in the gravel pits upstream from there that we can make visual observations. Stream gauge at Cachetti Road, which has been there for a couple of years, has been retrofitted with the remote read. And then we have the gauge, the downtown gauge here in Rio Grande, and all of those are on the internet. As you recall, we may or may not take the step of installing a gauge at 22nd Street. We wanted to actually operate the program for a year before we went to the trouble of installing that, primarily because although it gives us a total outflow, if we're seeing good numbers at Rio Grande, I'm not sure that that's valuable information to Zone 3, and it also has a little bit higher projected maintenance cost because the channel changes so much there that it have to be recalibrated fairly often. So that's a year or two of operation expense. I should note, as you recall in the IDRIS, there is a component of that that talks about spending up to $25,000 a year to remove barriers, which would effectively allow us to have free fish movement with less flow. We did not report that as a project cost, based on my sense from your committee that we would hold off on that kind of an expense or any commitment until we see how this thing is operating. So those would essentially have to come back as individual items to be discussed beginning at the TAC. To make sure that they're worthwhile, I suppose, as far as the IDRIS goes.
The news had to spill in the Tribune, and so gave you a chance on TV to tell all our citizens about why that's not going to happen again. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we should remind ourselves that it's really a product of the TAC, and they're sort of pushing and prodding and asking questions that got us to where we're at, which we think is a good plan.
Pamela, anything?
Yes, I want to thank you. We were first up at Oceano, and it was an excellent presentation, and we had quite a few questions.
So we're already gathering information that was not available in the past, aren't we?
Yes. Much more detail. And I should say that some of the agency folks, National Marine Fisheries and others, I think we put them on to look at the website, but they've indicated, you know, with the bookmark function, they're able to monitor what's happening in the creek from 250 miles away, which is a good thing. Keeps us in the front of their minds, and which we'll talk about with the HCP.
It may be that they they will not be able to blame us for leaving a dry spot in the creek now.
Hopefully not.
So, any other questions for Mark on the IDRIS? And Mark, are you also going to talk about HCP, or is that going to be Dean?
I think Dean has some more information on the IDRIS.
Oh. Yes, on the IDRIS, Mr. Gehring, one other item. This was a question that actually you did ask at the TAC committee numerous times, and I didn't forget. I just didn't get an answer. The question related to the additional liability that Zone 3 might face in the event of implementing the IDRIS, which sort of prompted the presentations that Mark did at the very agencies. And I'll read both questions because the answer to both questions is the same. The question that which came up was if the existing water supply contracts, which each agency has, cover implementing the IDRIS, why do we need a proposed resolution advanced at the time by each agency? That was when we were asking each agency to consider a resolution. The second question is, if the existing contracts do not cover the anticipated liability of implementing the IDRIS, what don't they cover? And Jan Goldsmith, who is one of the attorneys for the district, sent us a response to that. And basically the response was that implementing the IDRIS, really, or any plan that was not, that's the answer I got. So hopefully that answers that question.
Okay, thank you. Anybody have any other questions regarding IDRIS to either Mark or Mr. Benedict?
Dean, one quick follow-up. You said the legal impact we're talking about, anything that's not in the agreement, and that's the which agreement are we talking about, the Habitat Conservation Plan?
The agreement between the agencies and the district for providing water.
Okay, the basic agreement.
Yes.
All right, if I'm not off track, we're to HCP processing status.
Yes, and again, I'll defer to Mr. Hutchinson on the status of that.
Thanks, Dean. Attachment 6-1, Doug Berg prepared a sort of a bullet point summary of what's been going on with the IDRIS. The focus of our work is with the National Marine Fisheries Service. Those are the steelhead people. You will recall that we also have U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service out there. They're concerned with managing red-legged frog and tidewater goby. National Marine Fisheries Service, when they first reviewed the HCP a couple of years ago now, wanted more information and more model runs on the impacts of various downstream release scenarios. Consultant had to go back and modify the model. They've done the modification. They've run those scenarios. National Marine Fisheries Service had more questions. We ran more scenarios. Those results are now with the agency. The agency indicates that they've looked at those. And so we're moving ahead to setting down with them in a technical meeting and trying to get a better sense of where they're going and what they understand about the HCP and what they don't. I think your attachment ends on February 28th. Mine is updated to March 14th. And we're in the process of actually scheduling the meeting with the technical folks to get down to brass tacks on this. So we're hopeful that we're past the technical stuff and now we can get down to the nitty-gritty reality of trying to make this program work on the ground. Related to that, there's some recent activity with the agency, the National Marine Fisheries Service, that we're hopeful could impact the progress of our HCP. National Marine Fisheries Service has done two things. The first is they're stepping into what they call recovery planning. As you may be aware, when a species is listed as endangered or threatened, the onus on one of the regulatory agencies, either National Marine Fisheries or Fish and Wildlife, about things like genetic diversity and whatnot. That's interesting reading if you can't sleep some night. They've held meetings in Southern California, in the Ventura, Santa Barbara area recently to talk about recovery planning there, and we've contacted them and asked about this area. We're told they intend to come and meet with us and other agencies in this area around the middle of April to talk about their recovery efforts. Along with that, they've also requested some information from us and other agencies processing HCP about how long we've been in the process and how much money we've spent to date on the process, with an eye towards prioritizing their response to the various habitat conservation planning efforts that are going on out there. I think some of the agencies realize that they need to complete these HCPs because they're starting to understand, as we do, that these things are key elements of the recovery plans. We believe that the Arroyo Grande Creek HCP should be near the top of the priority list. I just made a quick list. In addition to the effort that the district has put into the Habitat Conservation Plan, we can point out to the agencies that the urban stormwater plans, which will go to water quality, are being now taken up by the regional board and will soon be approved, so we can expect efforts to improve the runoff quality that goes into the creek. Zone 1, I have a meeting tomorrow, as a matter of fact, to kick off the effort to start moving their long-term maintenance plan through the permitting, the long three-year permitting process. So we can expect continuing habitat improvements in Lower Arroyo Grande Creek. Obviously, salmon enhancement, represented by Steph, with their watershed planning efforts. They're making a major contribution, ultimately, to water quality and habitat conditions in the creek. And the regional board is also working with agriculturalists through the Ag Waiver Program. All of these happening in the Arroyo Grande Valley, all of these things will directly benefit water quality and directly benefit the species. Obviously, one of the key elements is that we have water in the creek the right amount at the right time, which is the focus of the Habitat Conservation Plan. So we're hopeful that in conversation with National Marine Fisheries Service, we can convince them to put our plan on the front burner, and then we can then start moving this process more forward a lot more rapidly than it has been going.
Okay, any questions for Mark on that? Starting February 28th entry regarding Mr. Spina. I get the impression that he's concerned about how many HCPs he's got to review, and he's not actually reviewing the data we supplied. Is that a misconception on my part?
Well, I know that he's reviewed the latest data that we supplied because we gently continue to poke and prod. I think there are a number of agencies trying to advance HCPs, and they, along with us, have probably been talking with their congressional representatives about the slow progress, the amount of time, the amount of funds, and the lack of on-the-ground results that we're seeing from this effort. So it's good to see that National Marine Fisheries is making an effort to prioritize, which to me indicates, hopefully, I may be misunderstood in that, that they intend to actually finish some of these. I realize earlier I said, I don't want to be too critical, I used the term rapidly in the same sentence with my friends at a federal agency, and we may have different understandings of what that means.
Do you at staff think that this recovery planning is going to interfere with the HCP?
I think we have a good case that our HCP is one of the keys to recovery plannings in Arroyo Grande Creek.
And then last but not least, the activities of Central Coast Salmon Enhancement would seem to be beneficial to the recovery and to the HCP, in that perhaps there's some cooperation in barrier removal and things like that that can be done. Is that a...
We see the salmon enhancements watershed efforts to be going hand in hand with the HCP. One without the other is simply incomplete. We are working with salmon enhancement on modifications to the Arroyo Grande gauge to improve passage, and we're hopeful that as we move into the future, especially with implementation of the ACP, that we can partner on all kinds of efforts as it goes towards enhancing habitat in the creek.
Anybody else have any other questions? No? Okay, well, thank you, Mark. And anything else, Dean?
Not on the HCP, no.
Thank you.
Rec area ownership operations. That is Dean. You're going to talk about that.
Yes. There was at a past meeting some established what the conditions of operations of that are. Basically, the county will not interfere with any of the functions or the purposes of the Zone 3 district to utilize, store, and distribute the water. And there was a question about ownership of the property, and the joint powers agreement is clear that the district owns the property, and the district maintains the property as it sees appropriate. The reason the question came up partly was because earlier this year there was the recreation area is operated, the recreation area, the park portion of that is operated by the County General Services Parks and Rec Department. Mr. Mellon is, I believe, part of that department, if I'm correct. The lake, except for boating, we don't deal with boats, but the dam, the level of the dam, the distribution of the water, there was a wastewater treatment facility in the recreation area that our operators, the County Utilities Division operators, do operate. There's also a water system that has wells and a distribution and a tank. The county staff does also operate that. And there was a sort of a request by the Parks Department to consider having the operation of the rec area water and wastewater system contracted out to basically an engineering firm, a consulting firm, a wastewater water operator, because of efficiencies, because of a duplication of overhead in the county budgeting system. Public Works prepares a budget of how much it's going to cost for resources to operate. We have an overhead on top of those costs. We send that to General Services. Unfortunately, General Services takes that. They add some to it. They add an overhead on top of that, and the cost goes up. And the concern by Parks and Rec, who operate that facility, is that maybe we shouldn't do that and reduce one of the overheads and see what the price and the cost are for having a basically privatization of that operation. And they talked to an engineering firm in town that does that. They got sort of a rough ballpark cost. It appeared to be somewhat less than the costs of our total operations that we do annually. So therefore, they're considering that. Now, I haven't heard anything about that in probably 6 months or longer. Since then, the whole park and recreation thing has been kind of potable water system wasn't as much of a concern, other than we do have some long overdue improvement projects necessary for that. The money is not there because it operates on a cash flow type of basis, the recreation area does, and there's not money to improve a utility crossing, which is badly deteriorated even right now. So that question came up in the advisory committee, and the TAC were not really, the consensus was they weren't very supportive of doing that and just letting somebody maybe operate at a minimum cost and have things go downhill even worse. But nothing has happened on that recently, but I did want to give you just an update that the district does have control of that facility. They do own that property, and to the extent that the district can determine what happens or doesn't happen with that, from the agreement that I have, the district has the full power to do that. And of course, the Board of Supervisors of the district is the same board as the county, just different hats. So I just wanted to present that to you because that was a question that was asked in the past.
Just to make sure you're clear, Dean, when you say the district, you're talking about Zone 3.
Zone 3, yes.
Thank you.
So basically nothing can happen as far as changing the operation of that without our endorsement, as I understand that.
If you did not endorse such a change, if it were to come that way, the district board of supervisors could overrule you for whatever internal reasons they felt, but it would have to be a district board change from that perspective, yes. And I will mention that since Public Works is not in the business of maintaining parks, we're concerned about the wastewater and water facilities, which we our staff does a very good job on. We are sort of neutral on it. It's sort of an internal county thing about who does that and these overhead costs that I mentioned that are somewhat redundant.
Anything else, Tom?
Thank you. No.
Yeah. Bill?
Nothing.
Joe, you have anything on that?
No, thank you.
Ted?
No, thanks.
Pamela? You know, Dean, I'm actually not against the idea of a private entity maintaining those kinds of facilities. I just think that the contract needs to be carefully structured so that we don't suffer deterioration from lack of maintenance. And I think such contracts can be structured. So if there's some contemplation to entering into that, it should just come back to technical committee and the advisory committee for consideration, I suppose.
Yes, that
was the decision that needed to be made because the revenues were not where the expenses were, so we wanted to be able to break even as far as the park operation went. So it took a 5% decrease in the expenditures, Dean, you're correct, to create a balanced budget for the Lopez Rec area. And we're in the process of doing fiscal year 07-08's budget now, so we don't really have an update on that at this point yet as far as, you know, how the budget is looking.
I might comment off of something that you all said there, because, you know, it's been my experience that if you ask for a bid on a contract for a private enterprise, they know exactly how much it's costing you because that information is available, and they can always get a little bit under what it's costing you, and then the next year or 2 years, they're going to make it all back. So that makes me a little bit leery about a contract of letting this out, and especially your concerns about upkeep, maintenance.
Yes, we were aware of that when we gave them our costs. Yeah. However, I know our consultants in this county are excellent and have a high reputation, and we wouldn't think they would do that. But we certainly have to consider that when we're managing that or putting that together.
Yeah. And also, it may be that if this were to go out like that, we may be liable to fix those crossings up there that are needed to be fixed before they would even think about wanting to bid on it.
That's a very significant...
It's still going to be our responsibility, correct?
That's correct. That's correct. I think probably the cost of fixing those crossings are in excess of the budget that we have for the entire year. So that certainly would be a side issue that we would have to deal with.
All right. Thank you. Anything else on rec area ownership? Anybody have any questions at all on that? New business. Does any member have any new business? starting with Tom.
No, I'm fine, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
No, sir, I have.
No, thank you.
Nothing tonight, sir.
Mr. Earing, any new business?